If you have a Bible, you want to open up to Genesis chapter 37. Genesis 37. We're going to work with the whole chapter this morning. We're nearing the end of our Genesis series. And so one of the benefits of preaching the way that we do, of just starting at the beginning and working our way all the way through, especially in a long narrative like this, is that it gives us the opportunity to, on a day like today, go back and try to grab something that we talked about a number of weeks ago and then pull it forward. And we're all in a similar spot on that. It also means that whenever we come upon any given topic, we don't have to try to say everything there is to say biblically on that one topic, because more than likely, especially if we're working all in one book, that topic's going to resurface a number of weeks later, and we'll be able to come back to it and say more on that topic later. This morning is one of those mornings for both of those things. 10 weeks ago, on January 21st, we worked through what was the second half of Genesis 25. That contains the story of Jacob and Esau's birth, as well as the account of Esau selling Jacob his birthright for a bowl of stew. I don't expect you to remember that sermon perfectly. I expect you to remember it pretty well. One person, thank you. Was that Kurt? Oh, okay. Got him. I don't expect you to remember it perfectly. With a little bit of prompting, though, because if you were here, you listened on the podcast, we've all made our way through this. Hopefully by recalling the main thrust of that sermon, we remember generally what the topic was. The main point that morning, which will be the main point today again, is that divine sovereignty and human agency move in perfect harmony. Divine sovereignty being the will of God, the control of God over all things, human agency being the fact that we all make free choices. And that those two things work together in perfect harmony in terms of how, like, the world and humanity and history play themselves out. I'm sure you can come up with hundreds of examples of that in your own life. Tim, how did you end up being the lead pastor here? Oh, some combination of divine sovereignty and human agency. I went to lunch with a guy who was on the leadership team at the time named Fred. He asked me what my plan, where I saw myself 5 years from now, and if being a lead pastor was ever something I thought about, and I laughed at him. And then was it just that the leadership team made a decision, and Melody and I made a decision, and now here we are? I mean, we definitely made decisions, but I also believe firmly that God's providential sovereign hand was guiding the entire process, and that both of those things work together, and here we are 9 years later as a church. And so I'm sure you have those in your own life. But if you spent any amount of time thinking about that statement after that sermon, it's very likely that you thought, okay, the big theological truth makes sense, but some of the practical outworkings, Tim, are a little bit dicey on that. For instance, if my actions, human agency, and God's sovereign choices are always going to align, why would I ever worry about whether or not I sin? God's got it all under control, right? Like, it's all going to work out. Or if other people's human agency and free will leads to sin, but God is sovereign over all things, why would we ever be concerned about justice? God's got it all under control, so if it's all going to work out as it's supposed to, why would Christians be people who are concerned about justice in the world? To put the question more broadly, isn't a theological position like this bound to lead toward a sort of human passivity, like a laissez-faire sort of attitude where the actions of humanity just don't matter because God is in control? Those are all good questions. I think today in our passage in Genesis chapter 37, on a very practical human level, allows us to circle back around to some of those questions and pick them up from a few weeks ago. So we're going to work our way through the passage. We're actually going to read some portions, stop, talk about it, read some portions, stop, talk about it, just to make sure we understand what's happening. Because this is a pretty pivotal moment in the book of Genesis where things shift significantly for the last time, but where we also set up what most of the Old Testament is going to be in reference to, which is the Exodus event. So we're going to make sure we get the passage square, then we're going to zoom out and talk about some of these questions as it relates to God's sovereignty and our free choices. So if you've got Genesis open there in front of you, I'm going to start with just the first four verses. It says this. Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. These are the family records of Jacob. At 17 years of age, Joseph tended sheep with his brothers. The young man was working with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than his other sons because Joseph was a son born to him in his old age, and he made a robe of many colors for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not bring themselves to speak peaceably to him. Verse 2, these are the family records of Jacob. That's the 10th time that that little phrase has appeared in the book of Genesis. It's the last of those Toledot statements that organize the book of Genesis. And right from the beginning of that, in the next phrase, Genesis tells you that what we're really going to focus on in the family record of Jacob is one of these sons, Joseph. These are the family records of Jacob. At 17 years of age, Joseph. So he's our focus. And in like a real big picture sense, that's the last big shift in the book of Genesis. We started with Adam and Eve, and actually the first sort of account of them is pretty short. Then you get like 20% of the book of Genesis that's all about Abraham and the promises that God made to Abraham. You get a little interlude about Isaac. Then you get about 20% of the book of Genesis that's all about Jacob, the formation of his family, the time that he spends with Laban and Padan Aram, coming back down to the land of Canaan. And now you're going to get over 30% of the book of Genesis about Joseph. Almost a third of what Genesis has to say focuses on this one individual. The reason for that is that the Exodus event is the fundamental event of the Old Testament. It's the defining moment for the Jewish people as like a family. It's the primary Old Testament foreshadowing of the work of Jesus. And so understanding how they end up in Egypt so that they can make the Exodus is very, very important. So much so that Genesis gives about a third of its text to showing you how it is that Israel got to Egypt. On top of that, ending up in Egypt is also a direct fulfillment of something God told Abraham all the way back in Genesis 15. Genesis 15, verses 13 and 14, the Lord said to Abraham, "Know this for certain, your offspring will be resident aliens for 400 years in a land that does not belong to them, and they will be enslaved and oppressed. However, I will judge the nation they serve, and afterward they will go out with many possessions." From now until the end of the book of Genesis is setting up how all of that takes place. You're told in verse 3 that Joseph is out in the, or sorry, in verse 2, that Joseph is out in the field tending his father's sheep with his brothers. Now, not all of them. You're actually told specifically with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. That would be Dan and Naphtali, as well as Gad and Asher. So the five of them are off with some portion of Jacob's flocks and sheep, pasturing them, and strike one against Joseph in the eyes of his brother comes at the end of verse 2. He brought a bad report about them to their father. Are they doing something wrong out in the field? Are they mismanaging things? They're unfaithful in some capacity. Joseph goes back and he tells dad, and nobody likes a tattletale. So they're upset by that. Then you find out strike two against Joseph in the eyes of his brothers is that dad loves Joseph more than the rest of the brothers. And you don't even have to like read in and infer that. Verse 3 just tells you. Now Israel loved Joseph more than his other sons. And he gives him this robe. And the CSB prior to 2020 says that it's a robe of many colors. If you have an NLT, it says a beautiful robe. If you've got an ESV, it says a robe of many colors. If you've got an NIV, it says an ornate robe. If you happen to be holding a CSB that was translated after 2020, it says that he made him a long-sleeved robe. All of that translation hand-wringing deals with the word pasim. How do we translate this one word? Everybody's trying to get at it. In popular imagination, it's Joseph in the Technicolor dream coat. Right? That's what he's got on. And it's this symbol that dad loves Joseph more than he loves all of the other brothers. It's potentially a sign that Joseph is the one that dad is going to give the inheritance to. Now, how could that be? He's second youngest. He should be buried in the org chart as to who's going to end up with all of the stuff from dad's very significant inheritance. But bear in mind, he's the firstborn of his preferred wife, Rachel. So it could be that that's the reason why he's got such elevated special status. Verse 5. Then Joseph had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. There we were, binding sheaves of grain in the field. Suddenly my sheaf stood up and your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." "Are you really going to reign over us?" his brothers asked him. "Are you really going to rule us?" They hated him even more because of his dream and what he had to say. Then he had another dream and told it to his brothers. "Look," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun, moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." He told his father and brothers, and his father rebuked him. "What kind of dream is this that you have had?" he said. "Am I and your mother and your brothers really going to come and bow down to the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. We'll stop there. Joseph has two dreams, and those two dreams put together are going to comprise what is strike three for Joseph in the eyes of his brothers. He's not the first person to have God communicate to him via a dream in the book of Genesis. Abraham had that. Jacob had that. Even Laban had that. But this is the first time where someone has a dream and God is not recorded as speaking explicitly. Instead, everyone interprets the dream to mean something from the Lord. So everyone appears to understand exactly what the dream is conveying. Not only is Joseph dad's favorite, but in some form or fashion, God has also chosen Joseph. Two dreams whereby Joseph will be the greatest among all of the brothers. Verse 12. His brothers had gone to pasture their father's flocks at Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, "Your brothers, you know, are pasturing the flocks at Shechem. Get ready, I'm sending you to them." "I'm ready," Joseph replied. Then Israel said to him, "Go and see your brothers and the flock, or how your brothers and the flocks are doing, and bring word back to me." So he sent him from the Hebron Valley, and he went to Shechem. Shechem is about 50 miles north of Hebron. We were told last that Jacob and his family were living in the Hebron Valley after the death of Isaac. Now we're told that Joseph is supposed to go check on them near Shechem. The last portion of chapter 37 here said that Joseph's brothers could not speak peaceably to him. They could not speak shalom to him. Now Jacob sends Joseph literally to examine the shalom of your brothers in the flocks. Go up and check on the peace of your brothers in the flocks. Why would Jacob send Joseph to do that? Well, they're near Shechem. Think about what happened at Shechem. A couple of Joseph's brothers went into the town, murdered all of the men, and the rest of the brothers swept in behind those two, pillaged everything from the town for themselves, so much so that Jacob said, "You've made us odious to the people of Shechem, and if they attack us, they will overwhelm us because we are so small in number." So now the brothers are up there tending the flocks, and Jacob says, "Hey, that's dangerous. Go check and make sure that they have peace, that they're safe." Here's what we know. The brothers have no peace toward Joseph. They could not even speak peaceably to him. So who's actually about to be in the most danger? The brothers shepherding the flocks near Shechem, or Joseph going to see them 50 miles away from dad's protective umbrella? That's like the tension that gets set up for you. And then in verse 15, there's a little sidebar. A man found him there, wandering in the field, and asked him, "What are you looking for?" "I'm looking for my brothers," Joseph said. "Can you tell me where they are pasturing their flocks?" "They've moved on from here," the man said. "I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph set out after his brothers and found them at Dothan. That little interlude is supposed to tell you a couple of things. The brothers aren't in Shechem. They're actually 14 miles further north in a little place called Dothan. But it also sets up some irony. Joseph encounters the Shechemite all by himself, and nothing bad happens. "Hey, what are you looking for?" "I'm looking for my brothers." "Ah, they're not here. They moved on. They're a little bit further away." And Joseph says, "Okay, I'll go and find them there," and nothing bad happens. Then he's going to find his brothers, and something bad does happen. verse 18. They saw him in the distance, and before he had reached them, oh, it sounds like the prodigal son, right? Hey, here's our brother. No, next phrase. They plotted to kill him. The Shechemite was no danger. The brothers are. They said to one another, oh, look, here comes that dream expert. So now, come on, let's kill him and throw him into one of the pits. We can say that a vicious animal ate him. Then we'll see what becomes of his dreams. What began here with Joseph having dreams about his brothers bowing down to him, for Joseph is about to become a nightmare. They decide while he's long off that they could kill the father's beloved son, throw him into a pit, and put an end to the potential outcome of his dreams. It's worth noting here that most of what the brothers are jealous and angry about is not Joseph's fault. It is not Joseph's fault that dad plays favorites. Dad's done that his whole life. He did that with Rachel. Now he's doing it with his sons. And they're not mad at dad for that. They're mad at Joseph. It's not Joseph's fault that God, in his sovereign will, has chosen Joseph. And yet the brothers aren't mad at God. They're mad at Joseph. Joseph might not be completely innocent. Maybe he flaunted the coat. Maybe he unnecessarily shared or rubbed in the dreams. We don't know any of that. It also doesn't matter, which we'll come back to. Verse 21. When Reuben heard this, he tried to save him from them. He said, let's not take his life. Reuben also said to them, don't shed blood. Throw him into this pit in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him, intending to rescue him from them and return him to his father. When Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped off Joseph's robe, the robe of many colors that he had on. Then they took him and threw him into the pit. The pit was empty, without water. They sat down to eat a meal. And when they looked up, there was a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were carrying aromatic gum, balsam, and resin, going down to Egypt. Let's pause there. The first brother to step in is Reuben. And he wants to save Joseph's life and then come back and retrieve him from the pit. We don't know the reason he wants to save Joseph's life. The text doesn't tell us. Maybe he's just more compassionate than his brothers. Maybe he's more level-headed in the midst of the anger, the jealousy, and the hatred. Or maybe he's trying to get back into dad's good graces. After all, he slept with one of dad's wives, and we were told that dad never forgot it. So we don't know what the motive is. But he says, just throw him into the pit. And in his mind, he's thinking, I'll come back and rescue teenage brother and take him back to dad. So they all agree to do that, and we're told that they stripped off Joseph's robe, verse 23. In the Hebrew, they skinned it off of him. So this is not like your child comes in after playing outside in the cold and the snow, and you say, turn around, I'll help you take your jacket off, right? And they put their arms out and you pull it off. No, this is a violent thing. They beat him. Take the robe forcibly. They toss him into the pit. With no food, no water, and then verse 25, they sit down to eat a meal. You're supposed to see the cold calculus of it all. It reminds me of what popular history says Aaron Burr did after he and Alexander Hamilton had their famous duel. He shoots Alexander Hamilton. He's getting rushed to emergency care. Aaron Burr goes to a bar and gets himself a drink. It's like, I'm not really that torn up about the thing that I did. And you're going to find out later that as they ate, they were close enough to Joseph that they could hear him in the pit. In Genesis 42, one of his brothers says, obviously we're being punished for what we did to our brother. We saw his deep distress when he pleaded with us, but we would not listen. Then they see this group of Ishmaelite traders who are headed on their way to Egypt. Those are descendants of Grandpa Isaac's older half-brother, Ishmael. The text is going to go back and forth here in the next chunk that we read between calling them Ishmaelite or Midianite traders. Genesis is not confused there. The words were used interchangeably. In the book of Judges, chapter 8, we're told that now the enemy, that's the Midianites, had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. The best illustration here would be to say that like all Kleenexes are tissues, but not all tissues are Kleenexes. All Midianites were Ishmaelites. Not all Ishmaelites are Midianites. So it's a group of Ishmaelite traders, more specifically, they're Midianite, and the text is going to go back and forth. So pick it up in verse 26. Judah said to his brothers, what do we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay a hand on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers agreed. When Midianite traders passed by, his brothers pulled Joseph out of the pit and sold him for 20 pieces of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone. What am I going to do?" So they took Joseph's robe, slaughtered a male goat, dipped the robe in its blood. They sent the robe of many colors to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it. Is it your son's robe or not?" His father recognized it. "It is my son's robe," he said. "A vicious animal has devoured him. Joseph has been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth around his waist, and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and daughters tried to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "I will go down to Sheol to my son mourning." And his father wept for him. It's Judah's idea to sell Joseph to the traders. Reuben returns. Like, it appears that he went off somewhere else and then has come back. He sees that Joseph is gone. He tears his clothes as an act of lament. What am I going to do? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to engage in an attempt to deceive dad about what happened to brother. So they take the coat, they dip it in a goat's blood, they take it to dad as though Joseph is dead. And notice what they say when they get there. "Examine this. Is it your son's robe?" Not even our brother. Is it your son's or not? And note the progression of that robe up to this point. It was given by Jacob to Joseph as an object of love. It immediately became an object of hatred and jealousy to his brothers. Then it becomes this act of violence. They strip it off of him. They skin it off of him. Now it's an object of deception back to dad. It's also worth seeing the irony of how Jacob is deceived. When he stole Esau's blessing from Isaac, he deceived his dad by wearing Esau's clothes and putting some goat hair on his arm. Brother's clothes, little bit of a goat. Now they take brother's clothes, the robe, and a little bit of a goat, its blood, and Jacob gets deceived. And the account ends this way. "Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and the captain of the guards." The account ends and Joseph is in Egypt, not dead. But we know that he probably isn't going to die there, right? Because what were the dreams? All the brothers are going to bow down to him. So he can't die in the pit. He can't die on the way to Egypt. And he can't die in Egypt until something happens with these dreams whereby dad, presumably, and brothers come and bow down before him. So the end of this account, the thing that like hangs over Genesis for the rest of the book, is how do we get to that point where the brothers are bowing down to Joseph? Genesis, for 13 chapters, is going to show you how that plays itself out. And so the question is, how did the Israelites end up in Egypt? Well, you might say human agency. Everyone made some choices that landed Joseph in Egypt. Dad played favorites, gave the robe. Joseph shared the dreams. The brothers got mad. They wanted to kill him. Two brothers intervened. They ended up selling him. Some traders went to Egypt, sold him to Potiphar. This string of human choices. That's how he ended up in Egypt. But Genesis is going to tell you that it was also very much divine sovereignty. That Joseph ends up in Egypt because God sends him there. Joseph will say so himself in Genesis 50, verse 20. "You planned evil against me. God planned it for good to bring about the present result, the survival of many people." Hundreds of years later, Psalm 105, the psalmist is going to reflect backward on this whole account. And he's going to say, he, God, sent a man ahead of them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. So it was God's sovereign electing choice. God's providential work to send the dream, to protect Joseph, to raise him up from slavery in Egypt, to jail in Egypt, to sitting at Pharaoh's right hand, to lead the rest of the family there for safety during a famine. It was divine sovereignty. It was both. And so I think that leads to two questions. Because the story, the account, is a depiction of gross human sin, and yet also the sovereign will of God. So how does God's sovereignty impact the formation of our human free will and our human agency? And then I think we could ask a second question beneath that, which is, what about the sin of other people? How does someone sinning against me impact my human agency and the formation of my own human will? We'll take those two questions one at a time here. The first is this. How does God's sovereignty impact the formation of our agency? Well, God's sovereignty is never an excuse for sinning in our human agency. Never. Followers of Jesus have to get really comfortable trying to hold what appear to be two opposing things and to keep them in tension with one another. The two things we hold in tension here are that the follower of Jesus knows that it is a lamentable, grievous reality that sin exists in the world, that sin exists in us. In fact, followers of Jesus ought to know that more acutely than anyone else in the world, that all the brokenness in the world is so grievous and so lamentable and so heavy because ultimately, not only is it sin against one another as image bearers, it's sin against a holy and a righteous God. And yet, the follower of Jesus knows that it is a praiseworthy reality that God is sovereign. He's in control of all things. And yet, God's sovereignty is never an excuse for our own sin. So the follower of Jesus also has to know that God is never the author of sin, he's never the perpetrator of sin, and he's never the celebrator of sin. And all of those things feel like they're tugging on different sides of the very same rope. And how does all of that balance together? God's sovereignty over all things is never a cop-out for his people's sin. Paul says in Romans, well, should we just sin all the more so the grace can abound? And then he answers this question, by no means. We don't do that. Far be it from a follower of Jesus to ever think, well, I sinned grievously, but because that sin ended up resulting in this ultimately good thing, my sin is no big deal. It was never actually a problem. Is God's sovereignty nullified by the sin of humanity? No, absolutely not. If it were, then God wouldn't actually be sovereign. Does God govern all things? Yes. Does he govern all things, and all things includes the sin that happens along the way toward the accomplishment of his will? Yes. But does he will and commit the sin? No. I will and commit the sin. You will and commit the sin. We will and commit sin. And does my sin grieve the Lord? Yes. Is human sin deserving of righteous judgment? Yes. Do I know the mechanics of how all those things can seemingly pull on different sides of the same rope and yet exist all together? I don't know all the mechanics of that. But I do know that God's sovereignty over all things is never an excuse for me and my agency to sin and just think, well, God will take care of it. Okay, but then there's question number two. What about the sin of other people? I mean, now we're really talking about like Christian ethics. So the vertical thing is the theological deal that sovereignty and human agency can exist together, and yet the sovereignty never excuses my sin. The Christian ethics thing is like, what do we do on the horizontal level here? You sin against me, what am I supposed to do in response to that? Well, the sin of others is never an excuse for sinning in our human agency. Look, the reality of the narrative here is that Joseph is the very real target of all of his brothers' very real sin. The text tells us explicitly they hate him, they're jealous of him, they want to murder him, they end up harming him, they disregard him, and then they traffic him. If you're keeping score, that's a lot of sin directed at one person. But also notice that it's not just Joseph, who's the target of their sin, who ends up impacted by it all. Because once they've sinned against Joseph, now they've got to sin again to cover up their sin. So they sin against Jacob. Now they've got to lie. Pretend that the robe is, you know, has been impacted by an animal attack. And Jacob ends up impacted by the ripple effects of that. The standard mourning period in ancient Israel was 14 days. Jacob says, I will go to my grave in grief over the death of my son. So let me state this another way, as far as like Christian ethics go. Others never deserve the sin that we do to them, ever. the other side of that is that we never deserve the sin that others do to us, ever. It's fairly common to hear someone talk about this account in Genesis as though Joseph, in the telling of his dream, is like gloating somehow over the dream that he's had. But the Hebrew, like parse all the Hebrew verbs that you want, it's not in there. He reports the dreams. Everyone understands what the interpretation is. And I think that statement is made in order to somehow explain why his brothers feel the way they do about him and then what they end up doing to him. But let's just say for the sake of argument that on two separate days, Joseph wakes up in the morning, goes out to his brothers and says, "Listen to me, you peasants. You're all going to bow down to me one day because of this dream that I had." And then he does it a second day. And after he does it the second day, he breaks out singing, "Oh, I just can't wait to be king." Let's just, for the sake of argument, say that that's what he did. Does he deserve what they did to him? I mean, would that give them justification for wanting to murder him and then choosing not to murder him but throwing him into a pit? No, of course not. And once they've sinned against Joseph, would that give him justification to sin back? No. When someone wrongs us, does that give us license to wrong them? When someone gets the thing that I wanted or that I desired for myself, dad's love, the robe, does that give me license, justification to then sin against them? No. And before you jump to thinking that Reuben and Judah are like paragons of virtue in this whole thing, it's worth noting that though they advocate for doing less to Joseph, they don't advocate for doing something righteous to him. Throw him in the pit. Okay, though that's better than killing him, it's still sinning against him. Sell him to the traitors. Okay, though that's not killing him, it's still sinning against him. The lesser of two sins is still a sin. To quote Charles Spurgeon, "Of two evils, choose neither." Christians aren't supposed to play the game of, well, I'll just figure out what the least sin is and I'll commit that one against a person. That's still sin. Christians are supposed to say like, well, that would be the way that the world thinks, but I don't operate by that standard. I choose to do good to image bearers, to do what is right even when someone does what is wrong to me. Pull this forward into New Testament ethics. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, rear back and slap him, right? No. Turn to them the other cheek. 1 Peter chapter 3 says, all of you be like-minded and sympathetic. Love one another. Be compassionate and humble, not paying back evil for evil or insult for insult, but on the contrary, give a blessing since you were called for this. And those things seem to make sense even if they're hard to live out, but the hardest part of this whole thing is that this would also include sins of thought, how it is that we think about the people who sin against us. A list of holiness laws in Leviticus 19, verses 17 and 18 say this: do not harbor hatred against your brother. Do not take revenge or bear a grudge, but love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus says it this way in Matthew chapter 5. You have heard it said to our ancestors, do not murder, and whoever murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you, everyone who is angry with his brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Whoever insults his brother or sister will be subject to the court. He goes on to say, you have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. So you may be thinking to yourself, okay, well, I'm mature enough that I would never actually sin back. Like someone sins against me, I'm not just gonna like try to get one for one and sin back. To which I would say, push further. Someone sins against you. How many layers of your own heart and flesh do you have to dig down underneath to get honest with yourself about whether or not you wish something bad would happen to them in return? How many layers of your own heart and your own flesh do you have to go down in order to realize, I don't actually will the good of this person. I sort of want them to suffer a little bit because of the way that they've sinned against me. Christian ethics say, in light of the gospel, that's not the way that it works. You may also be thinking to yourself, well, what about reaping what you sow? Isn't it a biblical principle where if you do one thing, you sow the results of that? I mean, yeah, that's a biblical principle, but nowhere does Scripture say that I ought to help someone reap what they've sown. Someone sows sin against me, and then I'm like Wyatt Earp out here doing frontier justice, trying to make sure that we all get back the things that we sowed. Scripture never says that. Okay, so you also might say to yourself, well, where does justice factor into this whole thing then, Tim? Because you're kind of making it sound like somebody sins against me and I just let it go. To which I say, no. The picture in the Bible is that justice is something that followers of Jesus care about and work toward. But we can never let good biblical justice get tainted by our own flesh and sin so that it becomes retribution or revenge or vengeance. And so that even in our attempts to work justice in a situation, we work justice with the other person's good in mind, not their suffering or not their getting back what it is that they have done to us. We reap what we sow because there are consequences for sin that are built into the world. We reap what we sow because in the scope of eternity, God is a just God. In the words of Martin Luther King Jr., the arc of humanity, our history, is long and it bends towards justice. But we're never supposed to be like purveyors of vengeance who sin against others in order to bring about the consequences of someone's sin back upon them, or who watch another person sin against us or groups of people sin in the world in ways that we don't like, and then we just sort of sit back and hope that they get what's coming to them. We're supposed to be something different. And as we read these Old Testament accounts and these Old Testament figures, we should always remind ourselves that they ultimately point beyond themselves to Jesus. And so as the narrative here shifts one final time, I want to begin the Joseph account by continuing to remind us that the primary figure before us, Joseph, is not the preeminent figure in the biblical story. Jesus is. And so we shouldn't think to ourselves, oh, well, I just want to be like Joseph and not sin back. And I might end up in the pit, and I might go even lower and end up, you know, in metaphorical prison or something like that, but God is going to elevate me to the highest place, and then I'll be able to turn around and do good. I mean, maybe. But if Joseph is actually pointing beyond himself to Jesus, what do we see? I mean, Joseph had the love of his father lavished upon him in the robe. Jesus, for all of eternity, has existed within the lavish love of the Trinity. Joseph has that robe forcibly stripped off of him before he's thrown into the pit. Jesus willingly lays aside the glory of heaven so that he can take on flesh, robe himself in flesh, and come into the world. Joseph gets thrown into the pit and he's crying for help as his brothers sit nearby and enjoy a meal. Jesus is thrown into the pit of human evil and suffering when he's put on the cross, and the perpetrators of that sin gloat over their act and gamble over his clothing. And what you've got is Joseph, the beloved son of the Father, sent ahead of his people to Egypt for the salvation of God's people. He's going to save them from a famine. But what you're really pointing forward to is Jesus, the beloved capital S son of the capital F Father, who comes to earth where, having been crucified and raised from the dead, he might provide salvation for God's people from the just consequences of their sin. Joseph is the means by which the people of God end up growing and even thriving in Egypt, despite the difficulty and the brokenness of their situation. And then they're ultimately delivered and led to the promised land. Jesus is the means by which the people of God are brought together from every tribe, nation, and tongue. And then we thrive here in this world according to his word and his provision, despite the brokenness of this place, until he returns and takes us home. And the beauty of the gospel in this whole thing is that Jesus does not raise from the tomb and then go on a revenge tour. Jesus does not rise from the dead after suffering on the cross for the sins of the world. Forgive them, Father, for they do not know what they do. It is finished. They place him in the tomb. He raises from the dead. He walks out and he says, where's Pilate? I have some thoughts for that guy. Where's Caiaphas? He could have ended this before it ever started. Where's everyone who was in the mob that chanted for Barabbas instead of me and sent me to the cross and Barabbas walked free? Because I'm going to make sure that everybody gets what they deserve. No, what's the good news of the gospel? Hanging on the cross, Jesus got what you deserve. That's the good news of the gospel. And so you say to yourself, well, does that mean that people just sin against me and I don't care? No, it means people sin against us and we grieve deeply with the understanding that as we weep over the reality of sin, we can also weep over the reality of people who need the good news of the gospel. And as we do everything within our power and through the empowerment of the Holy Spirit to live lives that are shaped by the gospel, to seek justice that is not vengeance, to will the good of people who do wrong to us, we also proclaim the beauty of the gospel that empowers the whole thing. Because Jesus did not rise from the dead in order to seek justice or retribution. He hung on the cross as the act of justice. He rose from the dead to prepare a place for his people in the presence of the Father. And so we are to be shaped by that kind of gospel that looks beyond Joseph to Jesus. So Christian ethics tell us we don't just sin with impunity because God is sovereign, but we also recognize that the sin of humanity can't thwart the plans of a sovereign God. We don't use God's sovereignty as a cop-out for our own sin. And on the horizontal plane, as sin intersects with us, we don't have to worry about somehow like getting justice by sinning back against people. We can grieve over the reality of the sin, seek justice that's not tainted into vengeance, and hold out the beauty of the gospel in both what we say and how we live. Amen. Amen. If you're able, let's stand up. We'll close in song.